From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, in today for Celeste Headlee. The coyote has long been a controversial animal.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Wile E. Coyote. Genius. I am not selling anything, nor am I working my way through college. So let's get down to cases. You are a rabbit, and I am going to eat you for supper.
Later this hour, we'll explore the debate over coyote hunting. Georgia now incentivizes killing coyotes, and we'll talk about why. That's ahead this hour, but first, we continue to talk about Confederate monuments in Georgia. We heard from Georgia State University professor Richard Stafford on this, who says that he has close personal connections to both the Union and the Confederacy.
I had a great-great-grandfather die on both sides of the war, but I don't see that there's a place for monuments that celebrate an attempt to overthrow the United States or topple the United States government in favor of the Confederacy. And it was illegal what we did here in the South, and it should not be celebrated in statues.
Here are your first thoughts. This is Brandon Stokes in Americus.
The fact is that if we take these statues down and these monuments down, we cover up the fact that the South tried to brainwash the United States and believe into believing in the Southern cause. To take these monuments down would be basically covering up the propaganda of our parents and grandparents.
We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. We talked yesterday about historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. We looked at a new documentary that traces their history going back over a century. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution is also looking at the role of HBCUs in America. Their latest series is HBCUs, A Threatened Heritage, and it tracks the health of the country's many black colleges. Of course, there's a large concentration of them right here in Georgia. With me now to discuss this project is Eric Sturgis, education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Also from the AJC is Ernie Suggs, who's the race and culture reporter there. Welcome, Ernie.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Adam.
So the name of your series is A Threatened Heritage. What is the nature of the threat?
Well, there are a number of HBCUs nationally, particularly the smaller ones, that are having a number of serious financial and academic challenges. Through our reporting, we found that many of them, you know, have graduation rates that are hovering around 20%. And when the national average is about 60% when you look at graduation rates. And many of them are having, you know, as I mentioned, significant financial challenges. So we wanted to take a deep dive and take a look at what's going on, what are some of the contributing factors and what some of the external factors are.
We'll talk about that. But first, what's the scale of the problem? And do you think that based on your reporting, we're looking at a wave of closures of HBCUs in the next few years?
Well, we hope not, but there are a lot of people who are predicting within the next, probably by like 2035, black colleges can be down by about 35 colleges. Right now, we have 101 black colleges that are accredited by the Department of Education. That means that they're accredited, so that means that these are historically black colleges. For those listeners here in Atlanta, for example, Morris Brown College is not listed among those 101 mm-hmm. because they've lost accreditation. So, you know, as Eric was saying, you know, there are a lot of financial constraints that are going on. There are a lot of schools right now who are, you know, who are struggling. So, you know, in 20, 30 years, there could be a drop in the number of historically black colleges. As you can, as your listeners probably know, at one point we had about 500 female women's colleges. Sure. Now we're down to about 35. Two historically black ones, Bennett College and Greensboro, and Spelman College, of course, in Atlanta. So, you know, we have seen instances where specific types of colleges have closed. There's a lot of things that have to happen for that to happen. There are a lot of things that historically black colleges and states, which control public schools, are going to have to do to make sure that that does not happen.
As we mentioned, we talked yesterday with filmmaker Stanley Nelson. His new documentary is called Tell Them We Are Rising, The Story of Black Colleges and Universities. And he told us that from where he sits, HBCUs are not struggling. They're, in fact, thriving. Let's listen.
These are, you know, strong, incredible institutions. You know, they have, you know, huge buildings and, you know, libraries, and they are, you know, viable institutions. I think that, you know, you have no more committed and enthusiastic alumni group than alumni of HBCUs.
Be that as it may, based on your reporting, gentlemen, it looks as though HBCUs still have significant challenges, as you said, declining enrollments and academic challenges, low graduation rates. What are the sources? What are the root causes of these phenomena that you're tracing?
Well, there are several things, and I think Stanley is right. I mean, but I think that he, in that quote that you played, there are a lot of things that he did not include. One of the challenges is the fact that, you know, for example, that a lot of talented black high school students have a lot of options now. When I was going to college in 1985, I graduated from high school in 1985. When my parents' generations were graduating from high school in the 60s and 50s, they didn't have a lot of options. So now, you know, a talented kid out of a South DeKalb high school with a, you know, great SAT score can go to Georgia Tech, or he can go to Morehouse. And if Georgia Tech presents a better financial package, he's going to go to Georgia Tech. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of competition, and, you know, we talk about, you know, diversity in higher education, but what's happening with that diversity push in higher education is that we're pushing a lot of our great talented students away from historically black colleges. So they're ending up at, you know, majority white institutions, and that's affecting the pool. But, you know, we need better alumni support. We need better state support. There are a lot of factors that go into what makes a historically black college less healthy than their white counterparts. And I think Ernie had,
yeah. And to echo on what Ernie was saying about state support, we found that a number of states have significantly cut their funding for higher education in recent years, some by as much as 50%. And that has a disproportionate impact on HBCUs. And then also there were some changes in some.
Why is that the case?
I think a lot of it came out of the recession. You know, there were
No. Why is it the impact disproportionate on HBCUs? For example, here in Georgia, we have three public HBCUs, I think.
Yes, that's correct. And so what you have is a situation where these are colleges that are dealing with, I mean, that are educating a larger number of low-income students and first-generation college students. And so, you know, they're dealing with a special population of students. And so they're trying, in many cases, they're dealing, you know, with different financial challenges. And so traditionally, these are schools that have, you know, have already had those challenges. And then, and then with these state funding cuts, it just makes it a lot more difficult for them to educate and to do some of the things that they need to do to graduate students.
And even in the best of times, public historically black colleges are not funded at the same clip as public white colleges. So, you know, even in the best of times, so in the worst of times, when we have these recessions, when we have these cutbacks, the black colleges are going to suffer more because they're getting less. They were getting less from the jump.
Indeed. We're speaking with Ernie Suggs, who's a race and culture reporter at the AJC, also his colleague Eric Sturgis, education reporter at the AJC. They have a big new series about the future of HBCUs locally here in Georgia and nationwide. The series that you've done includes a podcast, which is terrific because it gives us tape to play on the air now. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Robert Cole, who graduated from Morehouse College in 1987. He says that the fraternity environment there was crucial for him.
I grew up, you know, as an only child, and so I didn't have brothers and sisters in the household. And so when I went to Morehouse, you know, I looked at all of the fraternities because I wanted that bond, if you will. And I actually went on I got a scholarship from Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated as a high school senior.
Here's another voice from the podcast that y'all have done. This is Imani Watts, who is currently a sophomore at Spelman. And she recalls that when she first visited the campus, this is what sold her on it.
The environment was very eye-opening, I would say. You're surrounded by beautiful black women who are all achieving so much. It's very inspiring. The campus is beautiful.
So, gentlemen, those two quotes really speak to the perennial relevancy question. HBCUs, of course, historically started off with a very clear purpose, which was that black students were barred from admission at colleges and universities, mainstream colleges and universities in the South and in other places too. But now the question why is a little bit more present, especially when I consider the the factor that you were just mentioning, which is that one of the things that's drawing black students away from HBCUs is predominantly white institutions wanting to increase their diversity and therefore aggressively recruiting very, very strong black students and other students of color. And that's generally regarded, not universally, but generally regarded as a good thing, and yet it has this negative outcome on HBCUs. How can those two things coexist? If diversity at mainstream colleges is good, does that not inherently, implicitly argue that HBCUs themselves are not as important today as they used to be?
Well, I mean, that brings up a very touchy subject. I attended an HBCU, and I think the question you're asking, and not you, but the question that the world sure. asks is, you know, because white colleges now are accepting black kids and black kids are going to white colleges, and then what we have, our institutions are no longer valuable. They're no longer needed, which is a very false narrative. Historically, black colleges have always going to be they've always been relevant because of how they started. They're always going to be relative because of who they serve. Just because some of our best students, I should emphasize, some of our best students are going to UGA or Georgia State or Emory, it doesn't mean all of them are. And these black colleges still serve a role. You know, Eric is the numbers guy, but there's still a lot of kids at these 101 black colleges right now who are the first people in their families to go to college. I was the first person in my family to go to college in 1985. That totally changed the trajectory of my family dynamic. And this is still happening now. So when you have, you know, whatever the number is, of first-generation students who are able to go to, you know, North Carolina Central University or Morehouse or Tennessee State University, that's big. That's important. And so, you know, I hate to dominate the conversation, but last night I went to the Fox Theater to watch the 30th anniversary of School Days, and that's Spike Lee's historic movie about historically black colleges. Mm-hmm. And it was 5,000 people there in their historically black college sweaters and their Greek sweaters, dancing in the aisles, celebrating black colleges. And I think that's what kind of it's all about. It's not all about homecoming. It's not all about, you know, this family atmosphere, because academics and giving back is very important. But to question whether or not these schools are still relevant now is just kind of a wrong way to go into looking at them.
And when I and you played the clip from Imani, you know, it was interesting to talk to her, and, you know, I interviewed her and they talking to other students. And one of the things that you hear from students constantly is that they feel that it's a nurturing environment. And I think that's one of the things that still draws a lot of African-American students to HBCUs. And then you just, you know, you're just looking at, you know, what's been going on politically in recent years. You know, you hear many students talking about looking for colleges that are safe spaces. And so for many students, you know, they're looking at what's going on nationally with, you know, some of the controversial speakers at some colleges, and they're looking at Trump administration policies. And so for many African-American students, they still see HBCUs as a place where they can feel like they can get a good education, learn about their culture, and, you know, engross, you know, in so many ways.
Indeed. And you mentioned President Trump. In the last 30 seconds that we have here, everybody remembers that in the first days of his administration, President Trump gathered presidents of HBCUs from across the country in the Oval Office and signed some kind of executive order indicating an intent to provide greater federal support for those schools. Whatever happened with that?
When you find out what happened to that executive order, let us know.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, we have no idea. We have no idea. I mean, but, you know, I think HBCUs just have to keep plugging along. And one thing, and as we close, historically, black colleges have always been open. So, you know, there's this talk about, you know, are they still needed? But, you know, they're open. White kids can come. Hispanic kids can come. We welcome all.
We were speaking with AJC reporters Eric Sturgis and Ernie Suggs about their latest series looking at HBCUs across the country. Go check it out. It's on Second Thought. Stay with us.
And understand it.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Georgia's Department of Natural Resources begins its second annual Coyote Challenge next week, March 1st. Premise is pretty simple. Hunters who bring in coyotes that they've killed can win prizes, like a lifetime hunting license. The state says this incentive program helps control coyote populations, which can be a nuisance to people and to other wildlife. An ongoing research project by the University of Georgia is trying to work out how these mysterious animals live and how they might be different from their cousins up north. GPB's Grant Blankenship reports.
The hunt for coyotes starts in Dan Eaton's truck. Eaton's a pro trapper, has been since he was a kid. Long enough to be nonchalant about the dead beaver in the truck bed, which he sometimes uses to attract coyote. We are headed to a trap line Eaton has set on private hunting land outside Augusta, Georgia.
Everybody wants you to trap coyotes for free until you tell them you're collaring them and letting them go.
Eaton's been releasing coyotes lately to include them in a new University of Georgia study. Biologists want to know how coyotes are thriving in the South and how they are different from those in the West and North. One thing scientists and southern deer hunters already know is that, unlike out west, southern coyotes are deer hunters too. Most landowners don't like to compete. They want the coyotes gone.
I told them after the study I'll come back and, if they're still on their property, and I'll catch those coyotes and take care of them.
We turn off a busy road onto gravel, a field on one side and piney woods on the other. This is the trap line.
Well, Jake, these aren't paying off, buddy.
The first couple traps are a bust. We drive through a muddy hole, and then success.
Oh, got a coyote.
The coyote works silently to free herself. The trap holds, but doesn't crush her foot. Eaton gets his choke stick ready. You've seen dog catchers use these things. Then Eaton goes to work. He calls to the animal.
Come here, buddy.
Then he zips up her neck with the choke stick. And it's back up the road.
So that's actually the collar transmitting to the receiver here.
That's Will Goolsby. He and Michael Chamberlain are the two biologists leading the study. They take blood samples, weigh, measure, and fit the coyote with the tracking collar. She's motionless and silent, except for her labored breathing. Biologist Michael Chamberlain.
They understand that they've been beaten. So they kind of lost the battle.
This coyote is one of about 160 Chamberlain wants for the study, a bit smaller than one in Chicago.
The idea with this study is to expand it to a much broader landscape.
That broader landscape is a mosaic of agriculture and woods, but little wilderness. GPS collars will let biologists watch for 2 years as the coyotes either hang around a tiny range or go further away, whether they're hunting alone like they do out west or more like wolves in groups. A third year will be for crunching data.
There's a lot of uncertainty about how they're interacting with other species. There's a lot of uncertainty about how we will deal with this animal as human beings as moving forward.
The trapper and the biologist find the coyote average. Adult female, about 30 pounds.
Pounds. 31 pounds.
Well, have you checked the frequency already?
I have.
She's calm as Eaton carries her up the road for release. She finally fights back when her feet hit the ground.
There you go.
Eaton unzips the choke stick. She leaps into the air, then sprints back into the woods. Stopping about 30 yards away, Michael Chamberlain.
Watch them many times. They'll stop and stare back at you, and then they'll go about their way.
Then she's gone. If all goes well, researchers will still track her with that GPS collar.
That was GPB's Grant Blankenship. As we mentioned, separate from all of that research, the Georgia Department of Natural Resources is planning to begin its second annual Coyote Challenge next week, where they're going to incentivize hunting of coyotes, offer prizes to hunters who bring in coyotes, prizes such as a lifetime hunting license. We're going to talk about that more right now with Chris Mowry. He's an associate professor of biology at Berry College. He's also one of the founders of the Atlanta Coyote Project, which aims to help humans and coyotes peacefully coexist in the metro area. And Professor, you were not a supporter of incentivizing coyote hunting in Georgia. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Our organization, which is based in science, has very much opposed the Georgia Coyote Challenge.
And why is that?
Well, we have to understand, first of all, why coyotes are here in the first place. And it's here, they're here because we as humans eliminated the red wolf in the Southeast through extensive trapping efforts, hunting, poisoning, you know, really a governmental-sponsored eradication program that occurred, you know, throughout the early parts of the 20th century. And nature's going to fill a vacuum, and certainly in this case it did. And so the coyotes simply moved in to fill that void. So that's the way nature works, is that there are apex predators and ecosystems, and we got rid of the wolf, and now the coyote is, you know, likely serving that role. So, So you know, I think that's the first thing that we need to understand is that these animals are here because we paved the way for them.
Well, does that not invite the question of if humans are responsible for the overpopulation of this animal, are humans not therefore responsible for addressing that problem through hunting or other means?
Well, humans aren't responsible for any overpopulation. You know, I would argue that there's not overpopulation. You know, these animals are very good at surviving and reproducing, coyotes, but there's a carrying capacity. Territorial behavior is going to limit the numbers, so they will not have more offspring that can than the landscape can support. So, you know, and again, they are here because we wiped out what was here in the first place. So, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, we've been tinkering with this, with nature. And so allow these animals to come in. You know, there are estimates that there are 100,000 coyotes killed every year in this country, if not more. You know, we're not influencing the coyote population. It is not our role to try to beat these numbers back. These numbers will stabilize themselves.
Well, the state of Georgia classifies coyotes as a nuisance animal, and this is primarily because of their tendencies as hunting animals. Here's Don McGowan with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources.
We've never had a documented incident of a coyote attack on a person. Now, we do know that on occasion, coyotes, being the opportunistic animals they are, they will take a small pet. And actually having a fenced in yard is not completely coyote-proof either. They can go over fences.
And it's not just about pets, it's also about agriculture. Here is Ben Hill, a hunter from Oglethorpe County, who posted a vlog about one of his coyote hunts on YouTube.
Well, everybody, that was a good, successful hunt. I was very glad I got this coyote. These people have had a real big problem with these things getting after their calves. They've been killed a couple in the past 2 weeks and lost a good bit of money. So hopefully this will be one last coyote that's going to harass these people's cows. So
Chris Mowry, Associate Professor of Biology at Berry College, as we said before, you oppose Georgia's incentivized coyote hunt that's coming up. What are these folks missing in how they consider coyotes to be nuisance animals?
Well, I would point to the DNR's own website that used to say, until I made and pointed it out, that, quote, the quote on their website was, "The coyote is a largely misunderstood creature, and despite its nuisance reputation, proves to be an asset in maintaining the balance of wildlife in Georgia." Now, conveniently, that disappeared at the instigation of this Georgia Coyote Challenge. The DNR also publishes a deer management plan. The deer management plan also said, similarly, coyote bounties are viewed as an ineffective tool. Wildlife Resources Division and the Georgia State General Assembly oppose coyote bounty programs. So they're clearly contradicting what they have said originally. You know, we are biologists who study these animals. We sent a letter last March at the start of the Georgia Coyote Challenge that was signed by scientists, by biologists who study canids from around the world, speaking out scientifically against this, that it's a bad idea from a scientific perspective. This letter was sent to the governor's office, to the commissioner of the Georgia DNR, and to the director of Georgia Wildlife Resources Division, and we never heard any response about that. So I think that's, you know, something that people should really understand is that this hunting, this really is a wildlife killing contest, is contradicting DNR's own statements, past statements.
So you're saying that not only are you opposed to the coyote hunt because the coyotes have a right to exist and they aren't particularly a nuisance to humans, but are you also saying that the hunt itself would be ineffective at controlling the coyote population, even if that were a goal to be pursued?
That's right. And in fact, there's lots of evidence that shows that it would be counterproductive. Coyotes are social animals. They're only adult males and females that breed, the alpha animals. They live in small family groups. And those adults essentially impede the subordinate animals from breeding. And once you disrupt that social structure by indiscriminately killing, you're not sure who you're killing. you're now freeing up these subordinate animals to then breed, and so you end up with more coyotes than you actually started with. So you have these unintended consequences. There are plenty of studies that show that this, and this is not unique to coyotes. You know, this is the way nature works. You know, the coyote just happens to be this social animal, and again, you know, there are limited members who breed, and disrupting that process is going to lead to you know, more breeders with larger litter sizes.
We're speaking with Chris Mowry. He's an associate professor of biology at Berry College and co-founder of the Atlanta Coyote Project, and we're talking about the upcoming Georgia Coyote Challenge, where the State Department of Natural Resources is going to be incentivizing hunters to hunt coyotes starting next week on March 1st. Hunters will be eligible for prizes such as a lifetime hunting license. Professor Mowry opposes this for all of the reasons that he's just been discussing. So if the science is so clear on this, Professor Mowry, that not only are coyotes not particularly a nuisance animal, and that hunting them doesn't really do anything to control their population, what's actually going on here? What is the goal of incentivizing coyote hunting in Georgia? Is it because hunting is politically popular?
Well, you know, people can draw their own conclusions. I you know, in my opinion, that's probably
what's yours,
what it
yeah.
is. Yeah, you know, the DNR's mission is to sustain, enhance, protect, and conserve Georgia's natural, historic, and cultural resources. You know, there are lots of people that, you know, enjoy all forms of wildlife. In fact, I've talked to privately to other DNR biologists who are, you know, privately opposed to this. You know, these people are biologists. They understand how the natural world works. So, you know, my only conclusion is that this is, you know, in response to pressure from the hunting community. And I, you know, I want to be clear that we're not opposed to hunting. You know, this is not... Coyotes can be hunted 365 days a year. There's no limit on the number of coyotes. There's no season on coyote hunting. You know, this is a wildlife killing contest. And I think even you know, let alone the scientific perspective, but from an ethical perspective, you know, a fair chase. You know, this was something that we brought up in our letter to DNR and to the governor's office that you know, there are hunting groups that are opposed to these kinds of wildlife killing contests, and, you know, for ethical and moral reasons. So again, we're not opposed to, you know, we're not speaking out about hunting in general, you know, but this is specifically about this wildlife killing contest.
There is an argument that hunting and even state-incentivized hunting, state-promoted hunting, can have a positive net effect on wildlife conservation because it gets people interested in the outdoors and invested in the idea of setting aside conservation areas, for example. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I do think that the presence of coyotes, you know, has... And again, the DNR once said this, and our own work with the Atlanta Coyote Project, I would encourage people to go to our website at atlantacoyoteproject.org and see some of the videos that we have posted of the diversity of wildlife that occurs in areas where there are coyotes. So I think this myth that the presence of coyotes simply you know, leads to that they're eating everything in sight, and it leads to a loss of biodiversity in a particular site. It is just that. It's a myth. You know, as far as hunting getting people outside, sure. You know, that's part of DNR's mission. You know, is there's a game management, you know, arm of the DNR, and so that's part of it. And as I say, we're not opposed to that. But it's just doing these incentivized, you know, offering a prize to someone of a lifetime hunting license to do what is essentially a detriment to the natural environment, we just think is wrong.
In the last minute that we have, Professor Mowry, it just occurs to me, I don't think I've ever seen a coyote, or maybe I have and I didn't know what it was. What's the most likely circumstance in which the average suburbanite is going to see a coyote, and what would they expect to see?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, is that these animals are naturally shy and wary. And so they, you know, they do very well around humans. So they'll adjust their behavior to be active at nighttime or dawn or dusk. You know, if you go out west, you see coyotes during the day, but they're very easily able to adapt their behavior. So they keep to themselves. You know, so it is rare for people to see them. But I would encourage people to enjoy them as part of the natural landscape. And if you see one, you know, count yourself fortunate.
All right. That's Chris Mowry, professor at Berry College, professor of biology, also co-founder of the Atlanta Coyote Project, a project that aims at helping humans and coyotes peacefully coexist in the Atlanta area. And we were talking about the upcoming incentivized Georgia coyote hunt. Professor, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Do you hunt at all? Do you hunt coyotes in particular? You ever seen a coyote? You have any experience with these animals? As I was saying, I don't think I've ever seen one in my entire life. I probably couldn't pick one out of a lineup. If you had any experiences with coyotes, we would love to have you weigh in on this question. Is it a good thing for the state of Georgia to incentivize the hunting of coyotes? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page. Just ahead, how a mariachi band made up of Mexican immigrants has adapted to the culture of the South. But first, a young adult novelist tells us the story of immigrants. This is on Second Thought. Coyotes tiptoe in snow after dark. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Valentine's Day has come and gone. Tomorrow, we bring you a story from a romantic candlelit dinner at where else? The Waffle House. Doesn't get any better than that. Sets the bar pretty darn high. But what was the most romantic meal that you have ever enjoyed? Give us a call. Tell us about it. Leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. In less than 2 weeks, a critical program for many immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally is going to expire. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, shields immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children from being deported. The program's future is still unclear. It will likely stay in place beyond the March 5th deadline, thanks to two federal court orders blocking President Trump's move to end it. My next guest has been working on the front lines in Georgia for immigrant rights and brings her activism, of all places, to young adult fiction. She's a writer. Emory University professor Marie Marcourt joins me. Her latest book is called Flight Season. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here, Adam.
What's Flight Season about?
So Flight Season, like all of my novels, is a book that sort of dives into the challenges of living inside a broken immigration system here in the South. It looks at the ways that all of our lives are impacted by this broken system. And also it looks at the ways that people, through loving one another, supporting one another, and just caring deeply about building a future together, can do that, build a future together. So I hope that all of my novels, including Flight Season, is a hopeful one, but it's a tough time to be writing these stories. And Flight Season revolves around a young immigrant from Guatemala who becomes very ill and lands himself in the hospital. And it's a summer of just transformation, building friendships, and building love between people who really don't expect to see that coming into their lives through this summer.
How did you come to approach this topic in your fiction?
Well, for about 20 years now, I've been working in a range of ways around issues of immigration, and in particular undocumented immigration and asylum seekers. I started as an academic doing academic research on these issues and then became more deeply involved in advocacy and also service. I work in particular with detained immigrants and their families. And over the course of that time, I just have really developed some profound friendships that drove me into action and to a deeper understanding and a deeper desire to help others understand what it is, what this time we're living through is, and how it really impacts us all in all of our lives. And so I began to write, first academic writing, and I began to talk a lot to anyone who would listen about what's broken about our immigration system. And I realized that while we can understand with our intellects, and while most Americans do understand with our intellects, what's wrong with this system, I think what we really need in this moment is the capacity to build empathy and shared understanding more than anything. And I think fiction does that beautifully.
As part of your advocacy work, you volunteer with an organization called El Refugio. It's a ministry that helps families and loved ones of detainees. And we spoke with El Refugio's director, Amilcar Valencia, about the people that he helps with your assistance.
These are people who are going through difficult moments of having a father, husband, son, or a friend detained. This woman, her father was deported. Then her husband was detained, and she came again to visit him. And he was deported, too. Her brother was also detained and was deported. You know, her father, her husband, and her brother.
So I'm sure, Marie, that in the work that you've done with that organization and others, that you are constantly coming across very, very moving personal stories about real people. Are you modeling characters in the YA fiction books that you write after real people that you work with? I imagine that could be a particularly fraught thing to do. On the other hand, they say write what you know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So while none of my characters is directly one-to-one connected to a person that I've come to know and care about through my work with El Refugio, every story that I've written, I realized recently goes through that terrible place, the Stewart Detention Center. And every story that I've written is inspired by my desire to ensure that more people know what's happening there and what's happening in our communities and in our society. I also want to say it was beautiful to hear Amilcar's voice. Being a part of El Refugio has been really one of the most important things to happen in my life. And one of the things that I've learned from El Refugio that really comes through in this novel, Flight Season, more than in the others, is that sometimes what's required of us is to walk with people, to accompany them through their grief and their suffering, and to refuse to turn away from it. And I've really learned that, not only from my colleagues at El Refugio, but also from all the people that we've served and developed friendships with and relationships. So Flight Season is really a story about how to face grief head on, not to fear it, but to stay with it and to stay present to it.
We're speaking with Emory University Professor Marie Marcourt. Her latest book is Flight Season. She writes young adult fiction novels that are deal with the issue of immigration, something that is obviously very important to her. And we're talking about this in part not only because your new book is coming out right now, but also the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, is set to end March 5th. We're not sure if it's actually going to end on March 5th due to some pending court decisions, but this is the program that allows people who were brought to the United States illegally as children to be free from a fear of imminent deportation under certain circumstances. What do you think fiction can do to illuminate this issue for people that wouldn't better be done by journalism, for example?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I have come to believe, again, through my own experience and talking with many, many people about these issues, that what we need to build in order to move forward on finding a solution for something like what our current DACA recipients are facing, about 24,000 here in Georgia, is, again, not only to have a sense that it needs to change with our minds, but also to have a sense that we all are connected deeply, emotionally, and through the heart to DACA recipients in our community. And I've found that one of the best ways to do that is by telling stories. And I do tell stories in my nonfiction writing as well, but in some ways, fiction frees us to tell more profound truths. And for me, it's been really remarkable to be able to spend time sharing stories in a new and really, in a sense, more truthful and honest way through fiction.
Let's hear some more voices of people directly affected by this issue. If DACA goes away, a lot of folks in Georgia could be affected. Jesus Guzman is one of them. He arrived in the U.S. illegally as a child. He now calls Chatsworth, Georgia, his home. He's able to stay here because of the federal DACA program that provides at least temporary amnesty to many children who arrived in the U.S. illegally. Guzman says many people that he knows in the area have been deported nonetheless.
I go to church. In our church, I had met many people that now they not here because they've been deported. That made me feel so sad because many of my friends now they don't have either their mom or daddy with them. I was afraid that that can happen to me too, or my family.
And let's also hear the voice of Carlos Chavez, who works at a restaurant at Plaza Fiesta. He's the owner of a restaurant there. It's called, that's a large shopping center in Chamblee, by the way, just outside Atlanta, and caters to the Latino community. Carlos came to the U.S. from Mexico City and has called Atlanta home for the last 35 years. He says that that shopping center, Plaza Fiesta, has been a safe haven for immigrants.
Atlanta is very still very divided. South side, Afro-Americans, north side, more white Americans. So we are in the middle. We are like fighting between both of them, and we blend it in. Some people like us, some people don't. So it all depends on what day they get up on the right side of the bed, you know.
So Professor Marquardt, for people who are not directly in terms of their own person or their family, people who are not directly impacted by problems in America's immigration system, for people who are not directly touched by what we're talking about, what's the one thing that you think they need to know?
Well, first, I would urge them to pause for a moment, look around, pay close attention, and recognize that all of us are directly impacted by this broken immigration system. Second, I would really like to say in response to those two clips that the young adults who have DACA are extraordinary people. They're extraordinary not only because some of them are, you know, Harvard Medical School students and extraordinary in that way, but they're extraordinary because they are every single day getting up, getting out of bed, working hard to build a future that they know could be pulled out from under them at any moment. They are a model, an example for all of us about how to move forward in these very difficult times. So I want to make sure that we hold them up as extraordinary in those everyday ways, and see them as a part of our community, as embedded in our community, and not somehow as victims set apart.
That's Marie Marquardt. She's a professor at Emory University and author of young adult fiction dealing chiefly with immigration as a topic, and her new book is called Flight Season. She's going to speak Saturday night at 7 o'clock at Little Shop of Stories, terrific bookstore in Decatur. Good luck with that, and thank you so much.
Thank you. It was really great to be with you.
And listeners, if you are affected by the imminent expiration of the DACA program in any way, if you are a recipient, if you are an employer, anyway, please get in touch with us and let us know what you think. Let us know what you're expecting is going to happen in your community, assuming that DACA does expire as scheduled on March 5th or soon thereafter. Let us know what you're seeing from where you are sitting. Get in touch with us. We're at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, and you can always reach us on our Facebook page, and we might feature your comments on the air. We heard there how Marie Marquardt took her own experiences working with immigrants to inform her writing. Georgia is a hub for first-generation immigrants. Gwinnett County, for example, has a huge immigrant population, and 20% of its residents are Latino. We sent producer Sean Powers there recently to hang out with a mariachi band. For the last two decades, this particular group has used music to bring people together. Sean brought back this audio postcard from a Mexican restaurant in the town of Lilburn.
My name is Luis Vasquez. I play the vihuela. It's a rhythm guitar. We're called the Mariachi Mexicanísimo.
Yo tenía mi cascabel en una cinta morada, en una cinta morada. Yo tenía mi cascabel.
We play all around in Georgia. The Latino population has grown probably five times, six, seven times since we started playing. We've tried to play a little bit of everything, rock, classic rock, some pop songs, you know, whatever comes out, we try to stay up to date and still play the traditional classic American music and the traditional mariachi Mexican music. Growing up, my father's also mariachi. Actually, I'm a third generation. My grandfather was also mariachi. If they could see us, they probably wouldn't like it too much, you know, because some mariachi players are really like, they want to stay, keep it traditional. But, you know, since we're over here, we have to adapt and, you know, give it our little seasoning to the music. You got ready for a song? Yeah, make a request. What song you like to hear? Pick a song.
Let it go.
Which one, honey?
Let it go.
Let it go.
All right.
Snow glows white on the mountain tonight. Not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation. And it looks like you're the queen.
My name is Adam Wasichowski. This is my wife, Estrella, and my daughter, Ani. We pretty much come here every Thursday, minus Thanksgiving, Christmas, and maybe one other Thursday a year.
Specifically on Mariachi Thursday, because we really appreciate their music.
Well, now they know, let it go.
To move with the times and with your location. They're here, they're in Atlanta, which is really, I mean, when you think about it, the percent population of Latin American is so high here. You don't really think about that, but it is. So you gotta be able to cater to that, you know, and not just that, but everybody else too.
Here I'll stay, let the sun rise, show.
Story was produced by Sean Powers. We're closing out today with more music from the band Mariachi Mexicanísimo de Atlanta. That's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you. We talked earlier about the future of historically black colleges and universities. If you attend one of these schools, if you went to one, we'd like to hear from you. What's your alma mater, and why did you decide to go there? What was your experience like? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can find us on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.